Good morning, brothers and sisters. Love and greetings from the Austin Ecclesia. On this, the penultimate day of High, I'll be giving some comments on the last two chapters of Esther. Now, let's go back to the chapter 8. In the closing of chapter 8, we read that Mordecai was elevated, the edict of the king was publicized, and they had a celebration. They had the authority to protect themselves. Chapter 9 starts off with them following the edict. Things are starting. Things are the events are kicking off. What was the edict? They could assemble themselves together. Something we take for granted in this country, or well, maybe we used to. They could protect themselves. This was defensive only. They could take the property of those that attacked them. Both sides had regal legal authority, and neither side were rebelling against the king. So continuing on, in verse 3, we read, help the Jews. This in Rotherham translation has extolling the Jews. The rulers, the lieutenants, were praising the Jews. The implication being that they were telling the people not to attack. I can kind of envision it as Mordecai is an up-and-comer. You don't want to get involved in this. Only inaction is required. Don't get involved. That brings to mind Zechariah chapter 8, verse 23. Thus says the Lord of hosts, in those days shall come, it shall come to pass that 10 men shall take hold of, out of all languages of the nations, even shall take hold of him, the skirt of him that is a Jew, saying, we will go with you, for we have heard that God is with you. Even Haman's wife said, you will fail if you attack Mordecai. Continuing on. The sons of Haman, they are listed as killed. And two things I'd like to bring out about that. The first, there's a book called The Chaldean Paraphrase, and that has a couple of natural reasons why, possibly why his sons were killed. They were enraged to their own destruction. Some had thought that it was due to Mordecai's advancement instead of Haman. Some had thought it was due to Haman's death that made his sons more outrageous and resolute to attack. But whatever the case, the enemies of Israel and the day they thought would be victorious was the day that Israel was delivered. And speaking of Haman, look at 1 Samuel chapter 15, verse 3. Now go attack Amalek and utterly destroy all that they have. Do not spare them. Kill both man and woman, infant, nursing child, ox, sheep, camel, and donkey. It is clear that Saul was commanded to kill Amalek. And obviously this did not happen. We continue on reading in verse 13. And it's almost if Samuel is talking to a petulant child. He says, and Samuel came to Saul and said unto him, blessed be thou of the Lord. I have performed the commandment of the Lord. Samuel's response, obviously, then why am I hearing the bleating of sheep and the lowing of oxen? Saul said that they have brought them from the Amalekites, for the people spared the best of the sheep and of the oxen to sacrifice unto the Lord God. The rest we have utterly destroyed. See here that obviously, he did not follow the commandment of the Lord. Now, this failure had long-lasting effects. The failure of both Saul and Israel had long-lasting effects. Throughout the time, David was fighting the Amalekites. But even though it had long-lasting effects, Israel, they were punished, but they were never abandoned by God. And this is a theme throughout the book. Continuing on with the Amalekites, I believe this is the last time the Amalekites are mentioned in the Bible. And again, they were commanded not to take a spoil in Samuel. And here, they did not take a spoil. So it appears to be the completion of that. Second thing, throughout the book, God's name does not appear. I looked, I wasn't able to find it. God is referenced, and we see the hand of God, but his name does not appear in the book. Some thoughts on that. Maybe like it is today, where there are no open, comparing it to like it is today, where there are no open miracles or prophecy, but God is actively working. I'm hoping to hear some comments if somebody has some thoughts on that. Continuing on to verse 16, we hear 75,000 were killed. Now, it always helps me to relate to a number. That's a large number, but what does that mean? What's a good way to picture it? And to ballpark that, it is the size of a stadium. It would be roughly the size of a stadium. The other thing is the troops, the Russians attacked Ukraine, that was estimated to be their losses last year from when they started the attack to July of last year. Continuing on, we see the Feast of Purim, the Feast of Lot. And it was established by two letters, one by Esther and one by Mordecai. It makes me think of where it says established things by two or three witnesses. And here we have the two witnesses of the letters. Moving on to chapter 10. And King Ahasuerus, and since it's only three verses long, I'm going to go ahead and read each one. And King Ahasuerus laid a tribute upon the land and upon the isles of the sea. This indicates to me that he was in total control of his empire. Why do I say that? Because revolting people don't pay taxes. And if you want confirmation of that, look at Ezra chapter 4, verse 13. Be it known or understood now to the king that if this city be builded and the wall set up again, then they will not pay toll, tribute, and custom. And so thou shalt damage the revenue of the kings. If you let the Israelites build their city, they're going to revolt. They're not going to pay taxes, is what this was saying. And looking at Esther chapter 10, verse 2, and all the acts of his power and of his might and the declaration of his greatness of Mordecai, whereunto the king advanced him, are they not written in the book of the chronicles of the kings of Medes and Persia? What are his acts? They're not stated. They're not stated here because they're not all that important. It's important that it happened, not what happened. Now going on to a little aside, the first part of this book, I remember hearing somebody say, ask yourself this question. Put yourself in the position of Ahasuerus. You have ostensibly just divorced your wife. Being a political animal, what do you do? Do you seek a political alliance marriage? Is there an alliance that you can assure up? Is there an enemy that you can make a friend by marrying a daughter or a relative? What does King Ahasuerus do? He holds a beauty contest. And so looking at this perspective is a way to think about, or maybe look at the value that Mordecai had as an advisor. Just a thought, something I'd heard. Now, looking at Haman, we see that it was all about him. He was interested in his welfare. He was after Mordecai, so he wants to wipe out the Jews. He was a bad advisor. He was willing to pay money. He was willing to graft, bribe. He had pride. What happens to whom the king delighteth? Wants to put on a big show. He wants to have a noble come be his servant. However, if we look at Mordecai, what do we see? Everything he did was for the good of his people. Didn't ask for external validation. He didn't want to make a big show of it. When he saved, when he uncovered the plot to kill the king, he didn't. The king found out when he wasn't rewarded when he asked about it, when he was reading through the books. And when we look at his advice, how did he advise Esther? This is something he'd been doing, obviously, for a while. She was coming to him. So something to think about. And then finally, in Esther chapter 10, verse 3, we read, Mordecai the Jew was second in rank to King Ahasuerus, preeminent among the Jews and held in high esteem by his many fellow Jews because he worked for the good of his people and spoke up for the welfare of all the Jews. And this makes me think of Proverbs chapter 11. The wicked worketh a deceitful work, but to him that soweth righteousness shall be a sure reward. A righteous tendeth to life, so he that pursueth evil pursueth it to his own death. And what a beautiful allusion to the kingdom age this book paints. Thank you.
I'd like to thank our brother Beryl for his opening remarks. These final two chapters will be now open for discussion on this great book of Esther, which comes to a conclusion. And as it's been mentioned, the lack of the mention of God in the chapter has been discussed a couple of different times throughout the week. And the brother, in his opening remarks, brought that point up again. But really, that's a wonderful reminder that God is ever present to help us in our endeavors in life when we're struggling with difficulties, even if there appears at the moment no tangible evidence of his presence. Let us never lose our faith in him, for ultimate deliverance can be ours if we maintain faith in God, as was the case here with the Jews. Perhaps a good summary verse for the entire book of Esther and the message of Esther can be found in Isaiah chapter 54 at verse 17, which reads, "No weapon that is formed against thee shall prosper, and every tongue that shall rise against thee in judgment thou shalt condemn. This is the heritage of the servants of Yahweh, and their righteousness is of me, saith Yahweh." Certainly a good summary of the book of Esther. Of course, also in these final chapters, we have the institution of the Feast of Purim, so I'm sure we'll hear some comments on that. And at this time, we'll go ahead and open up the floor to any that would like to make any comments. Right over. Oh, you got a battery problem. Hang on 1 second, Brother Seth. Brother Seth over there.
So it is working. All right. As we come to this big part of the story where the Jews finally defend themselves successfully, there's something in the way yesterday's chapters ended that's interesting. The phrase, "many people became Jews because the fear of Mordecai fell upon them." Now, just to review, A decree was out on a certain time the Jews were going to be killed, and it could not be reversed. The second letters came that allowed the Jews to defend themselves, which they would, but the letter was still in effect. Therefore, anyone becoming Jews were willingly putting themselves in the crosshairs of that first decree, though ultimately that first decree wouldn't be able to stand against the second one. And that's a great lesson there. It was the fear of Mordecai, a Jew, of God's people. The fear of God overrode the fear of men. And that's how we're supposed to be living our lives.
Brother Humphreys.
Just a question. If we look at chapter 8, verse 11, I think it is, it says that the Jews could take a spoil or a prey from this day. And then you look at chapter 9, verses 10, verses 15, verse 16, it says specifically that they did not take a spoil or take a prey. And just it's a question, what's the significance of that? And, you know, why did that decision get made?
Brother Brent?
I don't know if I have a perfect example of that, but I was thinking as we read that, we think back and there was Judas Iscariot, we know, betrayed Christ for 30 pieces of silver. There's Ananias and Sapphira that lied about the money that they made from selling a property. We read about Delilah yesterday, who betrayed Samson for 1,100 pieces of silver. There was Simon the sorcerer that we talked about yesterday afternoon with a group that were trying to buy the Holy Spirit with money. There was Demetrius the silversmith that tried to start a riot in Ephesus, I think it was, because Paul was trying to sway them away from Diana. And then there was the rich young ruler that was sad because Christ had told him that he had to give up what he had and follow him. And I think too often in the Bible or in present day, you just have to follow the money, so to speak, to see what influences poor choices. And I was thinking in reference to that Bible verse, and I might not have it right in Esther, but I was thinking following God shouldn't necessarily have a financial gain to it, or shouldn't have a financial gain to it. Our reward is yet to come. And I'm thinking the message that would send to the nations around as well, if they were looking to influence the Jews, now that the Jews were in a position of power, it just goes to show they couldn't be bought. You couldn't show up with 1,100 pieces of silver and try and influence their newfound power. So I think it's perhaps twofold. One is to send a message to the nations around that we can't be bought, that our prize is somewhere else. And then also that, you know, our reward is yet to come. So just a couple thoughts around that, maybe.
Brother Haim.
We thank you for the comments which have been this morning, but what it takes to mind the specific question is that when David came down and found that his household and the others were being taken into captivity, he came down and he told them not to take of the spoil, or that he wanted just what their things were. And I think it gets back to that. And it said that David made that a law in the land that he that stays by the stuff profits the same as those that did the work. I think it showed that it was faith in God. That was not that they were not taking revenge on the person individually. They were not to lay. They didn't lay their hands on the spoil. That it had a higher principle behind it. So I think that's the key behind that.
Brother Jim?
Brothers and sisters, I thought Brother Burl covered this subject pretty well in his talk when he was making the comparisons to the Amalekites. When Saul was to go down and destroy the Amalekites, they were to destroy everything they had. They were to take no spoil. They were to kill everything, every man, woman, and child, and utterly destroy this great enemy of God. And they'd been the enemy since the time they came through the wilderness. And I know we've been looking for types and symbols in this book. That's the great type and symbol in the book is Mordecai the Benjamite having a victory over the Amalekite, the Agagite, Agag, the Amalekite. Saul the Benjamite fell at the hands of the failed to carry out his duty against the Amalekite. And for that reason, we know that on the battlefield, he had his armor bearer try to kill him, but it left him alive, and an Amalekite came and slew him. So to my mind, the great message of the book of Esther is the great victory that this Benjamite had over the Amalekites and the failure of Saul, the Benjamite, to destroy the Amalekites and why the kingdom was taken away from him.
Brother Dan Wolf, in the back.
Just a couple things to add to what Jim and Brother Burl were talking about Saul. One of them is it says that I didn't have time to go back and look, but I'm pretty sure it says that Mordecai was, it ran it back through Kish. Saul was the son of Kish, so it even specified back to Saul's. I don't know if that was a different Kish or the same Kish, but anyway, it just kind of, that's what brought my mind back to Saul and Agag. The other thing was, God, provided his deliverance through, small numbers and small things. They weren't supposed to increase numbers of horses or chariots or anything like that. So anytime that the Jews gained something, particularly from an enemy like that, they weren't, in other words, the gain was coming from God. It wasn't coming from spoiling people. I think that had something to do, as well as what Brother Duell said. But I think in addition to that, it was to so that they couldn't say, oh, well, they got rich from destroying another set of people or whatever. The spoil is not what made the Jews successful. I think that was just the one last little piece I think I would add to what they were saying.
Brother Lenny.
Just change the thought a little bit. When we see, as it writes there, that, you know, Esther and Mordecai have, in fact, you know, have all authority and write these letters, you know, in the end of around the 25th, 6th, 7th verse is there. And I just wonder if people think this is right or not, but you certainly see that Mordecai comes to a position of authority. Esther, together, they're ruling, in effect, with, you know, under Ahasuerus. And makes me think a little bit of Christ and the saints and the kingdom age. And even when we get to the Feast of Purim and the sharing of things, the peace that occurs, I think he writes in there and he says something to the effect, to confirm the second epistle concerning the Purim, and he sent letters unto all the Jews throughout the 127 provinces of the kingdom of Ahasuerus, words of peace and stability. So I just wondered if it's correct, a thought. I mean, it's not dogmatic, but that, you know, this could be representing, you know, Esther and Mordecai and Esther could be representing Christ and the saints in a time of peace in the kingdom, and, you know, a time when the lamb shall lie down with the lion, kind of the wolf, that kind of thing. So it was just painting a picture in my mind, and I didn't know if anybody feels similarly or not.
Brother Seth.
I'd like to follow up on what Brother Dan was saying. The accusation against the Jews was, well, they certainly profited off this battle against everyone in the Persian Empire, didn't they? In the time of the Third Reich, where the Jews were doing quite good with business, that was the perception that started their persecution. But the thing is, if we go all the way back to the time of Abraham, Lot had gone to Sodom and Gomorrah. It was overrun. Abraham gathered up his friends and his family, went into battle, rescued them, brought them all back. And when the king of Sodom wanted to reward him with the spoils, he says, no, not even a shoe latchet. I don't want anyone saying that you made me rich. And so that phrase right there, when Dan mentioned it, it brought it to my memory. For the Jews, it wasn't about plunder. For Haman, it certainly was plunder. He says, you take care of these troublesome people and 10,000 pounds of silver is yours. No, the money was not the goal. They wanted to preserve themselves, and through God's hand, they did just that.
Any other comments? Brother Jerry?
I don't have a comment, but I do have a question. Feast of Purim that they celebrated, what does it actually represent, and do the Jews still celebrate it today?
I think it's still celebrated today, I believe, yeah. You know, unlike the feasts in the law that were instituted by God, this one was instituted here by Esther and Mordecai. But I think it's over, given the overall tenure of the book, it's approved by God. But it's a celebration of their deliverance from evil. But I believe it's still celebrated today, to my knowledge, Brother Beryl.
Yeah, I believe it's still celebrated today. There's a bunch of sites about celebrating it. One thing that comes to mind about celebrating it, there was a, find it. What is that? Sorry. Basically, the question was asked, how much do you drink on Purim? That was, and somebody in the Babylonian Talmud said, it is one's duty to leaven smeal, to make oneself fragrant with wine on Purim, until the difference between here Haman, cursed be Haman, and Barak Mordecai, blessed be Mordecai. That's obviously, it seems to me that's a bit of, seems to me to be a corruption of what was originally intended, but it's still and celebrated in some form or fashion today, it seems like.
Yeah, I'll share a few notes that I have on it. The observance consists of a preliminary fast of a sacred assembly in the synagogue when the Megala, or the roll of the Book of Esther, is unfolded and solemnly read aloud, and of a repast of home, following by rejoicing and the sending of presents. It is a reminder of an era of captivity, a memorial of the enemies and friends of the nation, a commemoration of divine deliverance. Purim signifies lots. That's in chapter 3, verse 7. It illustrates the truth of Proverbs 16:33, that the lot is cast into the lap, but the whole disposing thereof is of Yahweh. It points to divine grace, which was shown to Jewry and is a token of the that extended to all mankind, which in Christ Jesus is mighty to save, and it foreshadows the divine purpose. I think, like Brother Lenny was saying, it's maybe typical of the, you know, the enemies having been put down, the millennial reign of Christ enters in a time of peace and so forth. Brother Beryl.
Just one final thing to add to continue on with what was said about the Feast of Purim. It's interesting. It happens in the last months of the Jewish year. So the Jewish celebrate a 30-year or 30-day month. So they have a leap year, which also happens, and they put that at the last month of the year, leap month actually, that month comes at the last that becomes the last month of the year. So when they move the Feast of Purim to the last month to celebrate it, and when they do celebrate it then on the month that it's normally celebrated, they have a minor celebration to celebrate it. So I don't know the theory why this Jewish site that was talking about it was just explaining how it happened, and they didn't say why. So I don't really know why. And our brother mentioned that the book of Hadassah or Esther is read. They celebrate Purim for 2 days, and Hadassah or Esther is read on the first day, but it's not read on the second day. I don't know. Again, I don't know why. It's just that they went through a whole litany of procedures they go through and how they party, so to speak, how they celebrate it. And anyway, I just found the leap year part fascinating.
Brother Johnny.
Good morning, brothers and sisters. Brother Lenny asked, you know, can we see in this Christ and the saints? And we certainly can. There's just so much involved in the elevation of Mordecai to this great ruler, and from the sackcloth he was in, from nothing, so to speak. And it's a great example of Christ's people that are now in a very humble and contrite and ignored position, not even known about by the rulers of this world, to where they'll be the conquerors of the world. And it's because of their fear. When we see Christ come up from the south, and Russia has already destroyed the Tarshish power. The British American powers are driven out of Jerusalem, and they've destroyed it. And Christ and the saints come in to relieve them and destroy the Russians in the Battle of Armageddon. And when we look at that third verse of chapter 9, these officials help the Jews. For the fear of Mordecai fell upon them. And that's what's going to happen in this kingdom when this powerful Russian army Northern Arabs and Europeans and all that are with them that attack the Jews and destroy that what would have been the most powerful army, the British American alliance of the Tarshish power. And when they wipe them out, they're the greatest power in the earth. And now this little power comes out of Saudi Arabia and wipes them out. It will be mind-boggling to the world. Who were these people? How were they able to do that? And you look at that, that they have this fear of Mordecai, a fear of the immortalized saints, that they don't realize they're fighting immortals. But the point is of verse 4, for this man Mordecai, let's say he represents the immortalized saints, wax greater and greater. And as Brother Thomas shows, when Christ and the saints enter Jerusalem, they come in from the east. So they destroyed the Russians in the Battle of Armageddon. They come in from the east. And as the sun rises in the east, it gets brighter and brighter and brighter as it goes overhead. And so even though there's probably after that a 10-year proclamation of peace, there's still the effect that once the March of the Rainbowed Angel goes out and conquers the world, they become greater and greater and greater, more powerful as they go, conquering as they go. And then while they're in Jerusalem, they transfer the natural Jews into a fighting force. The natural mortal Israeli army is their fighting force. And it's interesting that the next verse of verse 5 says, thus the Jews smote all their enemies. And that's the natural Jews that actually use the natural weapons coupled with Christ and the saints and their supernatural powers to conquer the earth. So it's a wonderful harmony of the return of Christ and what the Jews themselves will be able to achieve, because they have been so mistreated and murdered by all these nations, especially the Catholic powers, since the Catholics came to power, that in Revelation we see, render unto her double as she did unto you. Well, that was done unto the Jews, both natural and spiritual. The true brothers and sisters were murdered also, but together they conquer the world. And I think Brother Lenny's correct. We see this beautiful thing worked out in the final chapters.
Brother Lenny?
Just a short comment. Over the last couple of years, I've had the opportunity to email with someone in Israel. During the course of the emails going back and forth, it was in March, and it was the month of where they celebrated Purim, and they do have some kind of customs ceremony. I was trying to find exactly in the emails before the class ended, but I couldn't find it. But they do have a thing, particularly the secular Jews. They go up. It almost sounded a bit like Halloween in some respects. Okay, that people would get up all dressed up and so on and so forth and celebrate this. And I found something in the Christadelphian magazine from back in 1926. And hold on just one second. I'll do it from memory. But in 1926, apparently they celebrated it by having fundamentally another beauty contest. And they asked all young virgins throughout Israel to show up in Tel Aviv. And then they had a determination who was the most beautiful of all and named her in effect for the that there was the symbolic Esther in a celebration of Purim back in. That was about 100 years ago. So it's still alive in some form or fashion.